Hi, this is Nick Baraglio of ForwardingPlane.net here on Software Gone Wild. Today we're going to talk with Yvonne Papagnac, Brandon Mangold, Brandon Carroll, myself, and Bob McCouch about some of the presentations in Networking Field Day 9, specifically about the SDN pieces, because we all know that SDN is the hottest buzzword in networking, storage, software, and everything else technology-related at the moment. So with that, let's just go ahead and jump right in.
Yes.
Do you guys want to talk about the SDN pieces or the network management pieces?
There's a difference?
Well, so I sent an email out like last minute that basically just said, I like what Mr. Tuggs posted about, you know, his breakdown that essentially compartmentalized Network Field Day into two segments, right? You've got your SDN slash programming, and then you've got your network management slash monitoring. I think I'd rather talk about the SDN pieces first.
Yeah, the other one is just an application.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right. So, I don't know. I think, you know, at least for me, I wrote a post last night about the NEC solution, which, frankly, I was a little surprised by. I don't know how you guys felt about that, but, you know, my experience with the SDN controller that they had, you know, 5 years ago or so is that it was very cryptic. It was like programming assembly language. It was essentially prohibitively expensive. And the documentation was, I'm going to go out on a limb and say not written in English as its first language. The translation
No, it wasn't.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The translation was equally as cryptic. But when they got up there and started showing stuff, I was, you know, I went in with an open mind, right? Because that's kind of how I work. But, like, I was kind of taken aback at how polished their stuff was. I don't know how you guys felt about that, but.
Well, they've been doing it for a long time now.
Yeah, they were early involved, you know, involvees in the open flow movement. But, you know, their initial foray into that didn't really. You know, it was a research project basically, but they've got this controller out there that's pretty slick.
Yeah, I've been talking to them for a while for that very reason.
Okay.
So
hey,
generally,
hey,
hey, no. Yeah. So I was going to say that ever since really it was like really really early on it was Floodlight and NEC, mm-hmm. And Floodlight was really the just. You know, a fun academic project one, right? NEC was the one that was really going after trying to be a solution that customers could actually buy. And like you said early on, it was kind of rough, but they made some advancement. They have a lot of customers. That's the thing about NEC has a lot of customers in Tokyo and Japan, right? And so they're kind of like the only game in town over there. People, you know, people want to use them because they're local. So they actually have a market. So they actually have, you know, pretty quick customer adoption. So they've been able to develop their product with those customers, and they're trying to make it more, you know, an offering that other companies in North America and Europe would want to take a look at. But they've had some time to work with customers and make that happen.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point that you made there is that they may not have huge footprint in the continental U.S., but they are fairly widely deployed elsewhere, right? I mean, they're big in the Asian markets. They may have some European presence. And
no, they don't.
They don't?
Nah.
What about in carrier space? I mean, I know that they're a carrier company.
I know of only one cloud provider who's using them.
Okay. So, I mean, I think that, you know, given their footprint within the market in Asia and stuff, that would give them a fairly nice segment to pull needs and requirements from. That's basically what you're getting at, right, Brandon?
Yeah, I mean, they – so I was honestly a little bit surprised that they had got the service chaining capability worked out in a fashion as simple as they did. Last time I looked at it, it was still very, very manual programming flows, you know, like – and it was almost to the point you had to build your own application still. So they've obviously spent some time working on those applications, and they've got it, you know, pretty well packaged. So between the CLI that we saw, I guess they were deploying. I'm trying to remember exactly. I know it was in the GUI, but I think they were pushing scripts, right? So he was blasting a script out. It was making the change, but I mean, it was all fairly simple and straightforward, you know, how it should be. But my biggest thing is that that was still, it's been 5 years, and that was still only one kind of application. I mean, you know, you look at some of the other solutions out there, that they've come just as far in less time. So that's the only piece that really kind of concerns me.
Yeah, that's a good point, too. I did like the fact that their demo incorporated non-NEC hardware in it. I thought that was a very clear statement that, you know, the controller stands on its own, right? You don't have to buy this turnkey thing from them, and you can use your existing Dell Whitebox / Brightbox switches. You can use, you know, whatever other OpenFlow 1.3 enabled devices and plug our controller in, and then you can do your thing with that.
Be careful. They do all the heavy stuff on the edge switches.
Right.
And on their edge switches, they have like 100,000 flows.
That's a good point.
Okay. And in Hyper-V, you can have as many flows as you wish, obviously, mm-hmm. or on OVS. So, yes, they can take anyone as their core switch. And because they're only doing layer 2 forwarding across the core, it will work well. But if you start using other people's switches as the edge switches, then the whole thing becomes almost useless. I know someone who was trying to do that. Well, a very large service company, let's put it this way, tried to sell him their own Brightbox switches with NEC controller, and it didn't end well.
Interesting. So but you may run into that problem with really any piece of hardware, right? And that just boils down to knowing the amount of flow table space you've got, and you know the speed of your flow mods in your hardware, right? So you have to go in knowing what the limitations of your existing hardware are.
Yeah, but right now NEC is the only one that has switches with enough flows in semi-production environment.
Okay.
The only one, the only other one I'm aware of is Interasys.
And so that kind of puts you in the case where, you know, if you want to use NEC's OpenFlow solution and have it work kind of as advertised, then you're using NEC switches as well. It sort of reminds me of the situation that SIP ended up in. You know, there's SIP is an open standard, and yet to get a fully functioning SIP implementation, you pretty much have to lock in with a vendor because of all the extensions that have to be in place for, you know, that standards-based SIP implementation to actually do everything you need it to do.
Yeah, not to mention that SIP has so many extensions that it's impossible to get two products that have the same feature set.
Yeah, but I wonder, are we not going to get there with, you know, is there not a chance we're going to get there with OpenFlow as well? Where
it's even worse, because right now the standard is lacking numerous things that you actually need to make it work in large-scale production.
Right.
So everyone is developing their own extensions, and of course, they're all proprietary.
That's exactly what I saw in the SIP market, you know, 5-6 years ago.
So it's like Microsoft, embrace and extend.
I like that.
What do you guys think about their TAP-AG stuff? I mean, that's something that, you know, in my opinion, the security bits are a little bit of the hello world of SDN, right? They're fairly straightforward to take care of, and they're very flexible and allow for a lot of the things that security teams, in my experience, have been asking for a long time. And they, you know, they've come up with their TAP-AG, for lack of a better description of it, solution that's, you know, in direct competition with things like CPacket and Gigamon and even Arista, for that matter.
Well, you know, as I was joking probably 2 years ago, this is the Hello World application for OpenFlow.
Yeah.
Yep.
Cisco has one, Big Switch has one, NEC has one, Arista has one with direct flow.
Yep.
I think the only thing that they really added, because they had something very similar quite a while ago, but I don't think that with their controller it was possible to send the same stream to multiple destinations.
Oh. Well, that's going to be, you know, that's a huge requirement for, you know, distributed intrusion detection systems.
Right? Yeah, but very probably they fixed that, and so they packaged this now as a separate application.
Yeah, my guess is they saw that as sort of a crippling limitation and worked through it.
Yeah.
Yeah, they had to.
Yeah.
It's not even a hardware limitation. Any switch that can do flooding can do this.
Yeah.
It was just that they haven't seen this use case, so they didn't implement this functionality in the controller.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that surprised me when you said that, because that's something that, you know, that's like a top-of-the-list requirement for me when I'm building out, like, a bro cluster or something like that.
No, but they didn't position themselves as a tap aggregation network when I first seen them.
Oh, I get what you're saying, yeah.
Yeah, it was the virtual tenant network. It was the cloud business.
I kind of suspect a lot of the SDN companies have seen the visibility fabric as a way to try to get a wedge in to an existing network. You know, I think it's a tough sell to get somebody to any customer, really, except for maybe some of the very progressive, very large scale cloud providers, maybe to just embrace a whole new vendor and give them a shot. I think the visibility fabric gives them an opportunity to say, well, you know, run this in parallel, see what you can do with it. You know, you get these added features that we provide without having to run data plane through it, basically.
Yeah, and you're spot on with that. I think, I mean, that's exactly the mechanism I used to get SDN into the network, right? I use security as the inroad.
Yeah, and if it crashes, who cares?
Exactly. And so I guess that strategy works, or else all the SDN vendors wouldn't do it, right?
Right. I mean, I probably stole that from Ivan, right? The security is the hello world of SDN. I mean, it just does the things that security guys have been asking for in a fairly supportable way, right? I mean, have you ever had a PBR, a bunch of stuff around for like a quarantine network or something like that? No one wants to do that. It's PBR. But when you get something like OpenFlow that can say, well, I just want to redirect this port, or just this MAC address or whatever, you know, it becomes, you know, infinitely more flexible at that point. And then it's palatable to the networking people.
But you're now stepping one step further, because what they were demoing was just the visibility fabric.
No, I know, that's a big problem too, especially when you're trying to get visibility on a network that might be 40 gigs on the WAN or 100 gigs on the WAN or in by 100 gigs on the WAN. That becomes nearly impossible to do. You have to break that out by stream.
Okay, let's put it this way. I don't think that many of us have that same problem.
Well, that's a fair statement, and I know that I bring that out every so often, but you know, that eventually that will be a problem for other people.
I guess that by that time there will be other switches as well.
Yeah, that's probably true.
But yeah, I understand what you're saying. The only people that I'm aware of, by the way, that can do this other thing that you mentioned, where you effectively use traditional layer 2, layer 3 forwarding, and then you implement PBR with OpenFlow to redirect the nasty flows, are probably Arista and HP.
Right. Yeah, Arista definitely does it. I mean, that's one of the big draws. HP can do some of the stuff on the edge ports. But Arista's big win is their tap ag, you know, for distribution to a distributed intrusion detection system. But
yeah,
we're kind of off the path a little bit at this point.
No, it's all software defined. Come on.
No, that's a good point. What about, what do you guys think of Cumulus? I mean, what was the? There was a lot of buzz around that, you know, when it was announced that Cumulus was going to be one of the presenters. I know I was personally pretty excited about it. I've wanted to love Cumulus, you know, and what they're trying to do for a long time, but I had yet to really have time to dig into some of the things that they're doing. But I did enjoy hearing some of the, you know, central management types of things that I was a little concerned about from them there. What were you guys' thoughts on that?
I just wrote about them yesterday. I like them. I think just, you know, I did some time on the workbench and it all makes sense. I mean, the only thing that I think is tough managing a cumulus or a switch running cumulus is dealing with all the multiple files. That's kind of a drawback when you're jumping into this file to make changes in this file. If that could be automated or scripted or, you know, whatever, then I think that's fine, you know. But
how about Brandon? You should stop thinking about networking like, you know, the thing we had 20 years ago on an AGS Plus with iOS 8.2. Because everywhere else you look, every other product has multiple config files.
Yeah.
And sometimes you even spread things over multiple config files just to modularize them so that you have things in different files, just so that you can cope with everything that's in there.
Yeah, that's true.
And just something I've said before is, you know, I genuinely don't believe that a cumulus switch is intended for you to SSH into it and get on the CLI and then go, you know, nano a file or VI a file and then, you know, sudo services network restart or whatever.
No,
I honestly think it's – I know that you can, but I really think that their intended model is more of the DevOps model, right? You're pushing configuration file updates using a configuration management tool, you know, Puppet, Chef, Salt, whatever.
Yeah, well, I think you're right on with that. I think that – and I've actually spent a little bit of time thinking about how, you know, how could that blend into existing not only Unix management tools but also network management tools, right? And so I've got tons of – BSD and Linux boxes that I have to manage, you know, both for my day job and personally. And, you know, I've got a set of, I didn't realize this until I sat down and thought about it. I've got this set of tools that I've written that are, I mean, I wrote them, so they're admittedly sort of kludgy, but, you know, they do things like grab everything in Etsy and push it to a Git repo and then push it externally. So I've got it, you know, it's basically poor man's rancid for Unix systems, right? And so you've got that kind of off the box ability to do those things as you would a Unix system, but then you've also got this extremely powerful set of tools in that you can use, like you said, Puppet, Chef, Salt, to go and centrally push configuration, or CF Engine for that matter. That's the one that I'm most comfortable with. Mm-hmm. You know, you set your promises up and then it just does its thing, right? And it's just this Linux box that happens to have 48 Ethernet ports on it.
So then maybe I guess I should say it this way. If that's what they're pushing, then maybe that's what they should be talking about a little bit more than here's our Linux operating system and you can go in and touch all these files and run Quagga and get in there and do your configs, right? Because that's
I'll be honest. I think that I think that to them that's implicit. I think that to the audience they're talking to, which are engineers who are already familiar with Linux, right? DevOps kinds of folks that to them they've been asking for 10 years why we don't just run Linux on a switch. I think to those people, it's implicit. I mean, I know some of those guys who, when they see, you know, Cumulus, their heart flutters and they go, well, of course. And so I think for some of us, we go, oh, why don't you talk about that more? But I really think for Cumulus's target market, they just know that. That's automatic. They go, oh, it's just running Debian. Perfect.
Yeah, I think you're right with that. I mean, but I think, you know, from a marketing perspective, gaining... Or maybe, and again, maybe they don't. Maybe they're not looking for this type of market. But from a marketing perspective, you know, and from an information sharing perspective, they should probably talk a little bit more about, you know, here's how you manage these things at scale, and here's some great examples, and you know, think about it. Don't think about it this way. Think about it this way.
Right.
But again, maybe that's not what they're shooting for, right?
Right.
Also, keep in mind that, you know, the ratio of servers to, well, hypervisor hosts to switches is like 50 to 1.
Right.
And then VMs to switches is at least 1,000 to 1. Okay?
Right.
So if someone needs a large-scale Cumulus deployment, he probably has a humongous scale of server deployment or VM deployment. So they already have all those skills.
Yeah, that's true too. I mean, and they're probably not targeting like a campus network or, you know, a distributed retail business type of network, right? That's not really their core audience.
No, I see them as like next generation Arista.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you look at they've got their own validated designs, right? And they've got an OpenStack validated design and a big data validated design and stuff. So, I mean, maybe they're talking a little bit more about it than I heard.
Well, I think what we're all agreeing on here is they're basically the quintessential cloud network, cloud provider network equipment vendor, right? Because they're making, and I'm guessing here, right? But they're making assumptions that you've got DevOps folks in-house, and that's how you run your business, right?
Yes.
They're not focusing on the guy that doesn't know Linux, right? He might know iOS or JunOS or, you know, FTOS or whatever. They're not focusing on that. They're focusing on the guy who is the systems guy that also has to run the network, and he already knows how to write some code. He already knows how to manage a Linux box, and he already understands how to set up automation.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, after the presentation, I was talking to JR briefly, and I was asking him just some of those questions. You know, how many customers do you have? How many ports do you support? And I don't know if those numbers were for public consumption, but I'll tell you that based on what he told me, you know, their customers have large deployments. Let's put it that way. The port to customer ratio was quite large. So I think that's a fair assumption that, you know, they're not targeting small companies. I think that they're targeting cloud service providers.
Yeah, you know, even bigger companies. I speak at Interop, and there are like 150 people in the room, and I go like, "Who has more than 2,000 VMs?" And I see like three hands.
Yep.
So I have a thought. This is the other Brandon. I've rejoined. Overcome my
hey, the other Brandon.
Efficiencies. I have a thought for you guys. This is something as an enterprise guy. Here's a soapbox topic I've been on with others. I assume you guys went straight from NEC to Cumulus, but my whole thing is as we continue, you know, we spent a lot of money building our last incarnation of our private cloud data center, right? I keep thinking hybrid cloud and eventually, you know, predominantly public cloud is somewhat inevitable. I kind of see it like most, you know, you see the evolution of, you know, electric systems or other things like that. I can't help but seem to think that there's going to be more enterprises putting more workload in the cloud. And it's already happening with SaaS options and things like that. So a lot of us are already moving to Office 365 or whatnot, right? And so in theory, we're already kind of doing that. But more, you know, actually putting our own workload in the private cloud. So anyway, my thought is Cumulus really on the right track? Because are the cloud providers going to continue to explode exponentially almost as more and more people see economies of scale and start moving their workloads to the cloud? And at the end of the day, they're really trying to service the cloud providers, but indirectly they're serving a much broader customer base.
The indirect there is pretty big. And you know,
and that may be a whole different topic of, you know, growth of cloud services and cloud providers. But I think if that's their only play, it's a reasonable play just because of the growth of that market. That was my point.
Yeah, and also,
go ahead.
Keep in mind how well Arista is doing, and yet I don't see them in small data centers at all.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So there's also something really important to be said about figuring out the thing that you want to do. And then being the best at it instead of trying to be everything to everyone, right? It gives you the ability to focus on one really specific thing and then become a savant at that, right? Instead of saying, well, we can also do this, and we can also do this, and then you've got the, you know, you've got a Swiss Army knife that's 18 pounds.
Yeah, and it's not good for anything.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, actually, I think Cumulus, despite the fact that they didn't talk that heavily about it during their NFD9 presentation, I think for Cumulus, that is actually the manageability, that mass manageability through configuration management tools. Because in all honesty, I barely see Cumulus as an SDN company. Are they even an SDN company? Sure, there's some VXLAN support now, I think.
Yeah.
Right?
No, they're not.
Don't call tunnels SDN, please.
Right.
Yeah, that's
exactly. So I don't even think they're an SDN company. I think that
they're just not
a company that's got a whole new paradigm for mass scale switch management that speaks to the organizations that are doing big scale DevOps.
Not even that. They just have a different business model.
Mm-hmm.
Large scale switch management is not what they're doing. They are enabling it. You're doing it with Puppet, Chef, whoever.
Yes. Yes, they're enabling it. You're absolutely right.
That's the hidden gem in what they've got going, right? Is they have this, you know, enablement of however you want to do it, and where
as long as it's Linux, you can do it.
Exactly, which is, you know, that's incredibly flexible.
And so, you know, to your thing about break, I broke the NFD sessions really up into four major categories, right? There was SDN, in my opinion, which was Pluribus to an extent, not really. They're more on the Cumulus side. Then you had, you know, Brocade, Cisco, and NEC. But there was White Box was a significant part of this, or Bright Box, whatever you want to call it. I think that's exactly what, you know, they're enabling management, the rework of network management at scale, and White Box. That's what Cumulus is enabling, and Pluribus to an extent too.
It's nice that you all are focused on the management, but it goes way beyond that. And yeah, they use management to sell things because, you know, all the Linux people are happy that they have the tools. But just imagine how much easier it is to deploy new packages on a Cumulus Linux.
Well, I mean,
they're changing the whole mindset.
Right, that's going to depend on how you're managing them too, right?
No, but you know how easy it is to fix a BGP bug on a Cisco IIS or a Junos, right?
Yeah, all you got to do is reboot everything.
Well, first you have to wait for them for half a year to bake the image. Then you have to QA the image internally because who knows what else they baked together with your bug fix. Then you upgrade the box and you reload the box. And here you do apt get quagga and you reload the quagga daemon and you're done.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the big thing that I saw when Arista started doing routing protocols was that, you know, they had the ability to just reload that one particular binary, you know, and it used their, you know, proprietary backend SysDB to keep state and things like that. But the ability to say, well, BGP has a bug or there's a security problem with OSPFD or something, all I have to do is update that binary and then restart it, and I don't have to reboot the box. Things don't lose connectivity, and it's much easier to stream in the patches, right, like you were saying.
Now, don't be too optimistic. The last time I checked, they only used state in SysDB for spanning tree.
Ugh, no one wants to run that.
So they didn't have non-stop forwarding for OSPF or BGP, for example. Maybe they have it now.
Yeah, I don't know if they have it or not. I mean, I was just making an example of how you can just update the one thing that you need updated, and Cumulus has grabbed onto that as well. And I think done it in a way that not only does what, say, Arista does, but they also allow you to do it from a likely faster to update source, you know, in that they're using the open source packages, right? Apt-get update quagga. Done. Or if it's another, you know, if you're comfortable with it, you can patch the code yourself, package up a deb file, push it out with Puppet, and then you've got a feature or a bug fix that you need right now. You don't even have to wait for the open source community to do it. That's a hidden gem.
Now, just looking at the Arista, the way they package the software, it seems like you still get it in one big image.
So I thought at one point you could get updates of just particular binaries.
Yeah, but they probably have to send that to you. Whereas here you just have the repo, like the usual Linux repo, and you just say, hey, get me this one.
Yeah, I wonder if that's not a, kind of a mindset issue as well, because you know, Cisco's also started providing for certain editions of iOS, XR and XC, I think, come to mind, you know, package level update capability, and yet they also still produce the monolithic binaries, at least for XE, and that's certainly what most people I see still use. You know, I think I think there's the traditional mindset of the network engineer that you need to do a software update, you TFTP a new image on, and you reboot the device. So I think there's a little bit of a mental transition that some traditional network engineers will have to go through to get used to that idea of, oh, okay, just sudo apt get upgrade, you know, sudo apt get upgrade, done.
Yeah, I guess that we all have to go and stop being networking engineers for a year and go work as a sysadmin. To readjust the mindset.
I've already done that. I don't want to do that again.
No, you're good. You can do apt-get.
Yes.
So one other thing I was really pleased to see with Cumulus was it looks like they've been working hard to close gaps in terms of some of the usability with things like IFUpDown 2, right? You know, when I started looking at Cumulus maybe 18 months ago, one of my early criticisms was the fact that doing real-time configuration change and then persistent configuration change occurred in two very different ways, often with different syntax. You know, so it's the difference of doing, you know, bridge kettle commands versus editing the etc interfaces file. And the syntax is different. The way you do things is different. And I saw that as a big opportunity for human error. But it looks like they're closing the gap there by trying to make the product more oriented around just edit config files and then seamlessly, you know, reload services, restart services. And if they are successful in that, I think that's going to close a lot of that usability gap. And I'm glad to see that they're doing that and then, you know, pushing all of that, that code back upstream.
Yeah. I like the upstream push of changes that they make. I think that shows good tie-in with the community. You know, it's an act of good faith, and it also, you know, provides benefit to a much larger community.
Okay, that's your academic view. Let me tell you, I'm my commercial view.
You know,
if you do that, you don't have to fork the code, which means that other people are fixing your bugs.
Oh, absolutely. that's the hidden benefit. Well, where hidden is, you know it, and now everyone else does too.
So I don't believe that anyone is as altruistic as saying, well, let's do this for the greater good of the community.
That's probably true. Although I'm gonna happily live in my cup half full fantasy land with gumdrop houses and lollipop trees, I think.
That's the glass half full is the engineer's way of looking at it, right? So the optimist says the glass is half full, the pessimist says it's half empty, and the engineer says it's too damn big.
Yep. Now the engineer says, what's in the glass?
Yep. And why is it so big?
So, you know, let's move on to the Cisco offering, and this is something that I have almost no visibility into whatsoever. This was completely new to me because I don't work in an environment that has much Cisco product. So I'm really curious to hear what you guys think about what they had to say. You know, from my outsider's perspective, I thought it was pretty impressive. I can't say much else other than that.
So this may be the single area, the strongest area for me, because we're a big Cisco shop, and I feel dirty saying that, but it's the truth, and I can't get away from them.
Go with what works.
So I've been involved I don't know. Am I the only one? I guess I'm the only one here that's been on the cab and everything else. So I've been involved with InSemi since before they spun back in, and been on the cabs and everything else. So I wasn't surprised by anything that they discussed. The one thing I will say is that for an enterprise customer, I've been trying to look at all the potential options. ACI is one of the more realistic options today if I want to move to an overlay network kind of model. They do policy abstraction more so than, you know, traditional SDN control plane abstraction. So I actually think that's a little bit better given the maturity of that concept of pure control plane abstraction and the issues OpenFlow has. The other realistic players are NSX and Nuage, and they're more or less pure software, which leaves you with two separate networks to manage, really, at the end of the day. Your underlay and your overlay, whereas Cisco at least puts it all into one bundle. So those are the pros. The cons are it's still, you know what, even as big as Cisco is and as much engineering development as they have, my testing with it, it's not, I mean, just for me personally, I don't want to speak for everybody, you know, for other customers, but I don't think I could realistically deploy this in production. There's just no way. It still has a long way to go. A lot of polish is needed before I could really see putting it into production. Those are my high-level thoughts.
Brandon, let's be realistic. It takes 9 months to make a baby, regardless of how many women work on it.
Yes. You can't have 9 women work on a baby for a month and have a baby. Yes, you're right.
Exactly. So some things just take time, and the way they approach this whole thing with, you know, this whole unified fabric and the controller and policy push and everything. No wonder that you are hitting bugs.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anybody's surprised by that fact. I don't think I said anything that's going to shock anybody. But in my opinion, and it's just my opinion, I think the solution, the theory behind the solution they built is well-grounded. They definitely have a well-thought-out solution and theory. Now comes to the, you know, what Mike Bouchon talked about, and he's absolutely right. The execution of an idea is the more critical part of it. Having a good idea and having a well-crafted architecture is one thing. Execution is a totally different animal. And they're executing. I mean, they're executing fairly well, but they still have a ways to go. It still takes 9 months to make a baby. Ivan's right.
Yeah, it just depends on whether you believe that the overlay should be done in the hypervisors or in the top-of-rack switches. And I think we'll have those debates for the next 10 years at least.
Yeah, right.
Well, there's two schools of thought there too, right? So I completely agree with you and what you've been posting lately. You know, in theory, there's no real scale. The scale limit is going to be overcome. If Intel and the other players that have something to do in this space have anything to say about it, you know, with DPDK and other, you know, initiatives like that, you're going to get scale, reasonable scale and performance. Performance is more on the NFV side, right? Performance of the overlay really isn't a huge deal. I mean, you're still just moving, you're still, you know, moving packets or sending packets on a wire. It's just how do you encapsulate them? But the NFV part of it's the bigger part of the whole, you know, performance discussion, and that has nothing to do with overlays. So I think it really just depends on where you want to normalize that control of that overlay, right? If you're a shop that wants to do it in the network stack, then, you know, the way Cisco's doing it's going to make sense for you. If you're a really strong server shop and you'd rather just make your network this dumb thing that the network guys can continue to be dumb and you know, manage a simple network, then and software way is the way for you to go, I guess. That's the way I look at it.
Yeah, it also depends on how you want to consume things. So are you in a traditional model where someone will set up the subnets and the virtualization and server people will just connect VMs to subnets? Or are you in the other camp, more cloudy camp, where people can create their own network infrastructure?
So I think that creating the network infrastructure gets, in a lot of places, that gets into a very difficult to swallow scenario for you know, the networking and even some of the security engineers, right? Because you're touching things that at their core are essentially utility plumbing, right?
So right. So Ivan, oh, sorry.
No, go ahead. I'm done.
I was saying Ivan and I have said similar things. He worded it differently, but that's exactly it. But I think what I've been working through is, if you craft the policy, right, and so this kind of speaks to the policy, but really, if you craft the policy of exactly what happens when somebody provisions a new slice, basically, right? So, I'm an application owner and/or I'm a business unit or whatever, and I want to build a new a little island for myself to play in or to work in, and we're going to spin up apps in this new island. As long as you've crafted the rules around how that's done, right? I think the ability for sysadmins or application owners to spin up their own network slices isn't a big deal as long as it's predefined as to how that's going to work. But yeah, the security aspects, you know, typically most, and I'm speaking from an enterprise view. I don't really have, you know, a lot of experience in the provider space, but I'm sure it's similar. You know, the ability for people to spin up workload and then allow access in and out of you know, their new environment or new slice, that's the stickier part, right? And typically that most organizations have some type of more rigid control around the security aspects of that, and that's the harder piece to automate.
Okay, Brandon, so let me ask you this question. How do you handle that when you deal with hybrid clouds or when your application developers are escaping to Amazon?
So we don't do hybrid cloud officially on the books, right? And so you're to currently today, and like most organizations, you know, there's a segment of us, there's a segment of the IT population that's looking at that, and it's also come to the realization that our application developers are going to do that whether we like it or not. And you're exactly right. It's a cultural shift to understand that this is happening and that we have to enable it if we're going to control it. If we tell them no, they're going to do it anyway, and then we have no control over it. So you're precisely accurate. I don't disagree. And so to your point about how you consume things, I mean, it's really a cultural, you know, what is the culture of your organization?
Well, the other thing you got to remember too is if you tell them no, they're going to do it anyway. And the worst part about that is you might not know about it.
Yeah, but I always enjoy these discussions, you know, where people say, no, security, we have to deal with that centrally. And then I ask, but well, what about when your application developers go over there? And everyone goes like, yeah, that's okay. So as long as you don't do this in-house, it's okay. We don't care about security.
As someone who's been a security guy, I can tell you that makes me uncomfortable just to hear it.
Yeah, but you know what I'm saying, right?
Yeah.
So the first, Brandon, you're the security guy. What's your take on that?
I don't even want to touch it.
Smart guy.
Well, in enterprise, you know, you can get, it's a little bit easier to control things. You know, it's like, it's still aiming a fire hose, right? But, you know, you can enact policy and then you can put technology controls on top of those policies, right? And they can do, you know, 70% or whatever. But if someone finds an environment that they feel is more conducive to getting their job done, they're going to find a way to use it, right? Mm-hmm. So in my opinion, it's better to be able to see that. I mean, you might unlock the door, but you want to watch all the parties coming in and out of that door, right? You don't want to just walk away from it. In my types of environment, you know, they're open. So those types of things just really aren't an issue. And the way that they're dealt with is you basically just know about it, right? It's the devil that you know.
So I think to Ivan's point, so he started making that point. It was related to Cisco ACI versus the more pure software overlays. So the only thing that I can say is that, and so you made a good point, and I have to, it's funny because I got on this bandwagon about a year ago, exactly what you're saying. And then here I am kind of like going, oh God, I'm going to have to stick with Cisco because I can't figure out how I'm going to make some of these overlays work. But to your point, you know, I made the same points you did a year ago, and the Cisco ACI solution, unless you do, unless you push that policy and control to the virtual edge, because the virtual edge is the new edge, right? That virtual networking stack is the new edge. Unless you push all of your control and policy, NFV and everything else like that to that layer, there's no way you're ever going to be able to do a realistic IaaS hybrid cloud deployment, right? If your controls are still all in your, you know, network stack, good luck making that work in a public cloud.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Now, the only concern I have with Cisco's ACI, when we get to the fully virtualized environments, obviously a mix of physical and virtual is a different story, is that there are just too many wheels in the system. There are too many moving parts. You have the cloud orchestration system, you have the vCenter, you have the vCenter plugin, you have the Cisco ACI controller, you have the ACI fabric, you have hypervisors sitting on top of that, interacting with the fabric through VLANs. I just don't like so many moving parts, but maybe that's just me.
No, I think that there's a key there. There's things need to be easy for people to implement them for, you know, at a large scale. And so the more complicated, you know, anything becomes, the more folks are going to recoil from it because it's going to seem, A, like more work, B, too hard, and C, they don't want to deal with it.
So, more parts, more problems.
Exactly. And so the more that things can be simplified, the more likely they'll be to get adopted, right? That's my experience. And if it seems too complicated, I mean, they'll be able to ride on the fact that they're Cisco and they have, you know, a huge install base already and, you know, a lot of people that want their stuff. But, you know, eventually someone's going to go, wow, this is way too hard to do or it's way too complicated. And then they'll say, I can do this in a more sane fashion. And then that piece of that market share will start to go away. You know, as folks start to realize that it's easier to do a different way.
No, but there's this other moment as well. 9,000 switches aren't bad switches. They're excellent switches with or without ACI.
Right.
And they're not expensive.
That certainly helps.
And they're working on, I was going to make this point earlier, the Cumulus thing. So Cisco too is working on the more modular Linux, the lighter weight Linux core, and then you install packages on it, right? And then for routing, you just install the BGP routing packages. And I don't know if they'll ever adopt Quagga or anything like that, but they'll have their routing packages. And in order to update a part of the 9K's, you know, code, if you've got a bug in BGP, you need to update the BGP package in theory. So to Ivan's point, you know, the 9Ks without ACI is still a reasonable underlay, right? If you do overlay networking, the NXOS 9Ks are a reasonable underlay to look at.
Yeah, well, from my perspective, if I would be doing a brand new data center and deciding to go with overlays, the underlay would be either Arista or Cisco.
I think that's a foregone conclusion for most enterprises. That's certainly my conclusion. And to your point about smaller organizations, I mean, I don't know if I'm considered a smaller organization, but I'm not a cloud provider, and I'm definitely looking at Arista. I can't say anything more than that.
They definitely have some things that are attractive.
Yeah, but for the moment,
they remind me a lot of, you know, back in the early days of Juniper, where they had this sort of new way of doing things, and you could go and you could talk to them, and then they would listen to what you were saying and then potentially implement some of your suggestions. And I think that that's really attractive to early adopters. At least it's attractive to me as a, you know, as somebody that's a perpetual early adopter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, speaking of Brocade, what do you guys think of the presentation that they gave?
Oh, the Gartner slide was the best one I've ever seen.
Did
The welcome Ivan slide was, I think, the best one.
Yeah, yeah. I'm gonna have to agree on that one. That was one of my favorites. I saw him at Network Field Day 7, I guess, and you know they had a similar presentation as far as the demo went with their identifying elephant flows / DDoS mitigation SDN tool. So they sort of went, you know, it was similar to that, but you know, I like that, you know, that they're continuing to work on these things that are problems that are hard to solve. And I can tell you, I know that they have, so I think that probably the largest public, open flow based network is based at least 50% on their gear. So they're out there, you know, they're getting battle tested right now.
So, I don't, you know, I can't decide what's the most impactful technology I saw. Either the SD-WAN stuff or the Viato controller. Those, to me, those two, and or Cumulus. I'm still kind of undecided. But I guess with Cumulus has more of a niche impact, I think. I mean, it's a big niche, but it's still, at the end of the day, it's not everything. But what Brocade is doing with the Viato controller could have a huge, huge impact on the way many organizations look at building their networks in the next, you know, 2 to 5 years.
Yeah.
Can I disagree?
Of course.
Well, if you disagree, then I'm probably wrong. So.
No. No. The problem is that OpenFlow in its current incarnation is just not ready for large-scale deployments.
Yes, but the key here is that this is ODL, which is a modular framework. It's not tied to OpenFlow. That's my only statement for it.
Well, OpenFlow is its core competency, right?
Yeah. Brandon, you see, they promise that you have layer 2 forwarding, layer 3 forwarding, topology discovery, who knows what else. They're like 10 building blocks that they are talking about. And then they have these other 10 building blocks sitting below, and it says we have BGP and OpenFlow and PCEP and BGP LS and OVSDB and who knows what else. The real question is, which ones of the middle blocks, if you wish, below the application layer, can work with which one of the southbound protocols? Because you just can't do some things with anything but OpenFlow. How will you do topology discovery with BGP, for example?
Yeah, that becomes middleware at that point, right? And probably kludgy middleware at best.
Exactly.
Yeah, so here's when Nick asked that question early on of, you know, management versus SDN, which one are we going to talk about first? I get the point. I was joking saying there's a difference because at the end of the day, a lot of the benefits of doing something in SDN is limiting how much you have to manage, right? You manage a fewer number of controllers instead of a larger number of devices, and that significantly helps with management. So my focus is more on thinking if you can use the controller in pockets, segments of your network, so campuses, for example, where OpenFlow maybe makes some sense, you can greatly simplify the administration burden that you have today, and that's why I say it may have a pretty large impact, actually.
So I think that the management of it aside, the one thing that they're doing that I find interesting is that they're taking a project that is open source, that is, you know, community based. It's a Linux Foundation project that is widely thought by many to be sort of the reference OpenFlow controller or SDN controller, if you want to put it that way, and they're productizing it. And then they're doing what Cumulus is doing, was they're pushing it back upstream, which does what Ivan says and it does what I say, right? It builds market share and it gets other people to vet your code, right? So they're commercializing something that's out there for essentially for free, and they're saying, look, you can use this. It's got all this documentation. It's got this great, you know, community behind it, and you can call us if it breaks, right? So they're basically trying to pull the Red Hat model.
Yeah, exactly. They try to be Red Hat of SDN, and Cumulus is trying to be Red Hat of networking.
Right. And mm-hmm. and so, I mean, there's been rousing success with Red Hat. I mean, it's arguable, but I don't think anyone can argue the fact that Red Hat tends to be the de facto Linux for enterprises and for many other institutions as well. Right? I mean, they got in there, they figured that out, and they made it work. And now, you know, I don't know if they're profitable or not. I'm going to say they are, but
they are.
Yeah, I assume they are, right? Because they're it's not inexpensive, and so I think Brocade has sort of figured out that hey, maybe we can do this with this SDN controller, and not only are they first-ish to market with it, they're also sucking up all of the industry. SDN and OpenFlow and NFV and all of the people that are working on this are being consumed by Brocade, right? So they're clearly putting their eggs in this basket and they're banking on it being the thing.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point, right, is that they've clearly been making a lot of acquisitions in terms of talent and thought leaders in the industry. I think that they've got a long-term strategy. And, you know, as Mike Bushong said at one point, you know, that they're kind of acting like a networking startup, except they're not funded by VC, they're funded by FC.
Yeah.
They've got deep pockets due to their Fibre Channel business that gives them the luxury of being able to take a long-term strategy and you know, not have this pressure that we have to get something out the door right away. Let's make a visibility fabric and push that out tomorrow, right? And yeah. I really think that someday, relatively soon, you know, but not tomorrow, I think we're going to suddenly turn around and go, hey, look at that. Brocade has assembled this really, really good strategy of you know, product and services around it. I think that they still have some tricks up their sleeve, and I don't know what those are yet. I don't profess to be nearly that smart, but I think they have a strategy that they're executing, and they're just taking their time to do it right.
Yeah, I think it speaks volumes that they just hired Mike Bushong, right? I mean, he's got a long history of software stuff in the industry, and he's good at putting those things together in ways that are conducive to progress. You know, couple that with, you know, the rest of the Tiger team that they've put together, and they just keep getting more. I think people are already saying that. I mean, people are already saying, hey, you know, these guys are doing something that's different than most other people. And the fact that they're operating like you said, operating like a startup but not funded like one, I think that makes them, you know, quote-unquote dangerous from a industry perspective, right? Because they can shake things up and they have the money to back it up.
And they can be in that for the long run, whereas a startup has to produce something very early on, or the VCs get nervous.
Yep,
that's exactly right. I mean, Brocade's Fibre Channel business isn't going away tomorrow, right? They've got some time to develop new markets.
Yeah,
right.
Yep.
Yeah. So, like, when you talk about the Red Hat analogy, this is why I think that what they could be onto something really big, being early to the game here, because I'm just looking at it from a corporate reality perspective, right? I've been an enterprise toad for the last several years, and so I deal with the realities of culpability, right? Nobody wants to. So, in the enterprise world, here's the dirty secret: like you can make mistakes, but as long as it looks like you didn't make the mistake, right? That's the key. And so, having somebody else to blame, or having, you know, a throat to choke, or whatever you want to call it, and that's why Red Hat did so well. That's why, you know, a lot of these support models do so well. And the same thing is going to be true of SDN. It's so drastically different. It's quite a bit different for most organizations. And so, if you have a bundled solution that this company says that's, you know, a well-known company, they're an incumbent in a lot of companies because they sell, you know, Fibre Channel, and Fibre Channel is rock solid. And the same company who sells us this rock solid Fibre Channel network wants to sell us this packaged, you know, SDN network. Well, that sounds like the best way, because if I'm a manager and I'm going to make a call to go ahead and go forward with SDN, darn it, I'm going to want to go with somebody who's going to support. I'm not going to want to cobble together a bunch of guys who are on GitHub all day long downloading, you know, whatever, and yeah, writing custom code to make this thing work. I want to go buy a bundle from a big vendor that has a big name, that has a good reputation of building stable, reliable, deployable products, and if that's my first stepping stone into SDN outside of the data center, because again, SDN has a much wider impact. Data center is the smallest maybe spend of big companies, right? WAN and the campus networks, the LANs are probably the bigger spend. Yep. So if I want to revitalize my LAN infrastructure, and well, I'm sure you'll get the software-defined WAN here in a minute, which is really, really exciting. But if I want to revitalize my LAN infrastructure, that looks like a really good option to get started.
Not to mention the fact that, you know, as an enterprise, there's a pretty good chance I'm already a Brocade customer, right? I mean, if my Fibre Channel network's built on Brocade, there's already trust in that brand within the organization. And I think that goes a long way as well toward being able to make that case, hey, let's try their networking product, right? We've had good success with their Fibre Channel product. And I think that's a good opportunity for them as well, because what do they own? Somewhere well north of 50% of the market share on Fibre Channel switching, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so a couple things. One, I'm going to save software-defined WAN for the next one because we're already pushing over an hour here. But two, you hit the nail right on the head with enterprises, right? Even in the 90s, when I was still doing enterprise stuff, I repeatedly got told we could not do any open source solutions because, frankly, there was no one to blame but me when it didn't work.
Yep.
And they could fire me, but then they were still out something, right? They couldn't sue me because I was an employee. And so when Red Hat came in, I was out of enterprise at this point, but when Red Hat came in and did this, it's a light bulb went off in my head. I'm like, why did I not think of that? Because now you've basically got the throat to choke, and that's all they want, right? Functionality is always second to, you know, culpability in my experience. I mean, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean, that's a really good point, and Brocade has figured that out, I think.
Yeah.
Not
that's why
a secret
I say,
or anything,
and
but
did I successfully convince you a little bit, Ivan, or no? Am I still wrong?
No. You don't have to convince me. We agree. We're just politely disagreeing on the specifics. But, Nick, you just made my day. There is someone that's more cynical than I am.
There's a reason I'm not an enterprise. I'm typically not very cynical, but I would seriously rather go work at Pizza Hut than go work in enterprise networking again. It's I don't fit. You know, I don't fit in that environment. Nothing wrong with it, just not for me. Give me the service provider or the R&E network, and I'll be just fine. So yeah, we're a little bit over the time that I had allotted. I think we've got a heck of a lot more ground to cover too. So
we just do another show.
Yeah, I think we're going to do probably two more.
Yeah,
I'm fine with that.
So let's go around the table, talk about, you know, who we are and where you can find us, and then we'll sign off. So, Ivan, why don't you go first?
Oh, thank you. Ivan Pepelniak, regularly blogging at blog.ipspace.net and irregularly tweeting as at iOS Hints. So I guess I'm only tweeting when I'm sitting in California.
First, Brandon.
First Brandon, huh?
Yep.
all right. So you'll find me, of course, on the Twitters at Brandon Carroll, and blogging at globalconfig.net. But that's actually, I'm moving a lot of my blog content over to datanetworkingtalk.com.
Cool. Other Brandon?
Other Brandon. Brandon Mangold. I'm an enterprise toad. So I'm on Twitter at SDNGeek, and I currently blog at ccie31104.wordpress.com, but I'm going to be moving all that content over to SDNGeek.wordpress.com because CCIEs are so yesterday.
By the way, is it SDNGeek with the underscore or all one word?
All one word.
Bob?
I'm Bob McCouch. I'm a CCIE, even if that is yesterday. I'm a principal technologist.
Old sins.
I'm a principal technologist at a value-added reseller on the East Coast here in the United States. You can always find me on Twitter as at Bob McCouch, and I do my blogging at herdingpackets.net.
Cool. And I'm Nick Braulio, an insufferable blowhard that is on Twitter at Braulio, and I blog at forwardingplane.net.